listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2you.org. That's truth2letteryou.org. Also available on iTunes. And g'day to Alida in Florida, Desiree in Colorado, Patsy in Pennsylvania, Karen in Tennessee, Gail in Oklahoma, and Charles in Suffolk in the United Kingdom. G'day, Charles. And it's time for Pearls from the Torah portion with Keith Johnson and Nehemiah Gordon. G'day, gentlemen.
G'day.
G'day. Shalom, Jono. We're getting near the end, aren't we?
Tell you what, it's pretty close.
We're getting there.
Yeah, see the light here at the end of the tunnel.
I think we're actually basking in the light as we're doing this. And, you know, we were talking, I know, about doing the next section, you know, the next round of maybe the Haftarah. I think we have to really pray about that. Yep. Well, what we really need is for the people to post on Jono's page, truth2letteryou.org, and tell us, you know, is this something they want to hear? Do they want to hear us discussing the prophets? Or have they just had enough of us from talking, you know, with 54 sections of the Torah? We don't want to hear anymore. Right. Maybe that's. Let the people speak.
Let the people speak. It's a possibility. But I tell you what, we're squeezing everything out of it. And the last two have been we've set records in the last two, over 2 hours in the last two episodes. And so, boy, let's see how we go with this one. But today we're
hitting our stride. This, you know, we've finally figured out the shtick.
You reckon we've finally figured out that that every episode should be at least 2 hours long?
I think it should be.
There you go. Well, look, today we are in... Nehemiah, just pronounce it for me. What is it?
Kitetze.
There it is. Deuteronomy 21:10 to 25:19. And look, just to make sure that we go over 2 hours, I feel the need to go back in time a little bit.
Uh-oh. You're not going to bring up Harry Potter again, are you?
No. No, because, and I'm just warning everyone, this one is probably going to be this is not a G-rated program, this one here, I don't think. But I just want to go back in time a little bit because we sort of skipped over something, and I think we need to touch on it before we begin with 21 verse 10. And that is from 20 verse 10. There we go. When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace, to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now, if the city will not make peace with you, but go to war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when Yehovah your God delivers it into your hand, you shall strike every male in it with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and the livestock and all that is in the city and its spoil, you shall plunder for yourselves. And you shall eat the enemy's plunder which Yehovah your God gives you. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far away from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. Now, it goes on to say, but if the cities of these people which Yehovah your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them. It goes on to list them, of course. Lest they teach you to do according to their abominations which they have done for their gods, and you sin against Yehovah your God. So those that are very, very far away, which are not among that list, I better read it, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, Hivite, and the Jebusite is that list there. Now, here we are at the beginning of our Torah portion. This is 21 verse 10. It says, when you go out to war against your enemies, and Yehovah your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and would take her for your wife, and I'm sure she'd be thrilled. Then you shall bring her home to your house, and you shall shave her head and trim her nails, and she shall put off the clothes.
Can you read that last part? And what?
Shave her head and trim her nails.
She shall shave her head is what it says, right, in yours?
Yeah, she shall. Is that
okay.
What I said?
I thought you said he. Okay.
I might have done, but she shall shave her head. And it's another seashells by the seashore. She shall say, blah, blah, blah. Okay. She shall put up the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. And after that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And now, before I go on with the end.
Yeah.
Clearly, is it fair to say that clearly we're talking about one of these cities that are far away from you?
Right, because the nearby cities, they had to wipe everybody out.
Including,
and you know, you made a joking statement, Jono. You said, I'm sure she's thrilled about that. But actually, the way I read Scripture is that whenever there is any kind of a marriage, that Scripture doesn't need to come out and say, and the woman accepts it. because that's a given that whenever there's any kind of transaction or agreement, that both sides have to agree, not just one side. And in other passages, it talks about when a man takes a woman, it doesn't say, you know, and the woman consents, because obviously she consents.
Is it obvious? It is
to me. I think, I don't think you could have enter into any kind of a covenant. I mean, look, and we'll actually get to this a little bit later, but a marriage is a covenant. And we see this with when God makes covenants with us, you can't enter into a covenant unless both sides agree. God doesn't say to Israel, okay, I'm forcing this upon you. He asks them, and they say, Naseh v'nishma, we will listen and we will obey, or we will listen and we will hear. We read that back in Exodus. With Abraham, God accepts the covenant, Abraham accepts the covenant. Isaac and Jacob accept the covenant. If they were to come to him and say, I don't want this, I'm walking away, then obviously our forefathers wouldn't have been in this covenant. And I think the same thing is the covenant with the woman, that it's a given that she's consenting here. And if she's not consenting here, then she has the opportunity to continue to live as one of the captives, which essentially means a slave. So she's got that opportunity. So if she wants to marry this man, she can. And the whole thing of her shaving her head, so shaving her head is an act of mourning. Her parents were just killed in battle. Certainly her father, possibly her husband, were killed in battle, or killed in the conquest of this city. And the point is that she's shaving her head as an act of mourning. That's something that's actually forbidden in Israelite, but out of mercy for these foreigners, that this is their custom, God allows them to do it. So the way I'm looking at this is that, you know, that she's consenting to this relationship because maybe it benefits her, and, you know, in some way it makes her life better or for whatever reason. She has the opportunity to opt out.
Keith, it's incredible to comprehend that, because obviously her parents have just been killed. Her brothers have been killed. I mean, what goes through your mind?
Well, we talked about this in our earlier portion regarding this, unless that was a dream of mine. I'm pretty sure we did. It's possible it could have been one of my dream store pros that's taken over my life. But this issue of the fact that she is captive, and so, you know, the question is simple. Would you like to be my wife, or would you like to stay as a captive? And it even says, it says here that that she can change her clothes, which she had when she was a captive. And so, so here are your choices. I've taken your father's dead, your husband's dead, your brothers are dead. I'd like to marry you. Your choices are to marry me or to stay being a captive. And that certainly is her option. She could have said, yeah, I think I'll just stay as a captive. And that, who knows?
It's a matter of obtaining rights as well, I suppose.
So there are definite choices. I think there are choices, clearly.
And it shall be, it says in verse 14, it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. Now, does that mean that she is free, Nehemiah, of the covenant that they've made?
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting. This is something. This is like a sleight of hand that the English does. So the Hebrew word for divorce in the Torah, actually in the Tanakh in general, is the word shalach in the PL, shilach, shileach. And that's exactly what it has here, v'shilachta, which you could translate legitimately. I mean, this is how it's translated in other places. And you will divorce her. You could also you could translate it that way. You will divorce her linafsha to her soul, because literally this word means to send away. And basically, divorce in biblical terms is you send the woman out of your house. You kick her out of the house, essentially. And now later on, we're going to see in chapter 24 that there's more to it.
Sure.
But certainly at the time of Moses, when he divorced Zipporah, he just, you know, you're no longer living with me. Bye.
Go back to dad. So you certainly shall not sell her for money, and you shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. Now, she's obviously not going back to the status of a slave again.
Right.
So she's actually, in a sense, set free.
Right.
What's interesting, and I think this is really interesting, and I think about this from the perspective of what's called being fair. So she agrees. So let's just say she agrees. Okay, I've lost my father or my brother and my husband. I've agreed to be your wife, and then you don't like me. I don't please you, etc. So it would be maybe natural to think, well, look, you're going back to slavery. You're going back to be a captive. And instead, the issue is, if you've taken her to be your wife, and there's an agreement between the two of you, yes, we'll be married. And then you decide you don't want her. You don't just get to say, well, you know, hey, if you don't do this, I'm sending you back to prison. You know, it's like. you're going to be a free, she's going to be a free person, and she's going to be able to go out and
because he has humbled her, and right. it doesn't say why he has no delight. We're not given that information, which is interesting, but we're certainly given other examples as we go on here. It goes on to say verse 15.
So some of the Jewish Bible commentators, you know, from the Middle Ages suggest that he doesn't delight in her because he sees her without her hair, and the woman's hair is her beauty, and so she shaves her head as at morning, and he looks at her, and he's like, not so much anymore. So he might not have even consummated the wedding, and he already has to set her free because he they essentially entered into an agreement that they were going to get married, which is one possibility.
Perhaps. If a man has two wives, one loved and another unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, if the firstborn is of her who is unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his.
I think that's really profound, because what it's telling us here is that the right of the firstborn isn't granted by the father. It's granted by the father with a big F. It's something that's a God-given right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. If a man has a stubborn, rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gate of that city, and they shall say to the elders of the city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of this city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. I tell you what, I have two things to say about that. Number one, I think it would save a lot of problems in today's society, at least what we observe in Western society these days. Having said that, Keith, I also have to admit I would probably be one of them. I really, I read this and I look at myself back then and I think to myself, if I was back in the day, I don't think I could have blamed my parents for taking you to the gates of the city gates and the elders. And all I can say is I'm, I guess.
Here's exactly the point. If you lived in a society where they took you to the gate of the city and they chastened you, and that's just more
than
bad boy. It's much more than that. And then you find out, okay, wait a minute, they're going to stone me. Okay, I'm it's time to shape up.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I can say, if I was in a society that upheld this law and I was aware of it, I would do everything in my power to behave myself. And there's no doubt about that, yeah.
That we, first of all, the Jewish Bible commentators on this one have, because this is a very controversial passage even within Judaism, they've said this has never actually been carried out in the entire history of Israel. Mm-hmm. That this is one of these things that's more like, it's actually kind of like the city where they turn to idolatry and you've got to wipe out the whole city. That also has never been carried out. Mm-hmm. But these are kind of ideals that we can hold up, but that these things have actually never been implemented, at least as far as we know. Mm. The deterrent factor here for sure.
Okay.
The one thing that I think is very interesting, and the concept that catches my attention, is that it doesn't say that the parents actually stone him. It says that the parents bring him to the community. In other words, that this idea that the community is, there's this thought, about the community raises a child, and that if it's never been done, who knows? I mean, if it has or if it hasn't, I don't know how we would know 100% for sure. But I could see the fact that, the parents saying, "Look, we've done everything we can do. We've tried to give grace. We've tried to do this, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're bringing you to the community. So it's first to us as parents. Now it's to the community." And I could almost hear the community, having to sit down with this kid, saying, "Now look, here's the situation. It's amazing to me that it's bringing it to the level of others being involved in the raising of this child. And maybe it's never been done because the kid sat in front of the elders and the elders said, look, here are your options."
Yeah,
and I think you make actually a really good point, Keith, that we have three levels here. We've got the parents. We've got, in verse 20, the elders of the city. And then in verse 21, we've got all the men of the city, or all the people of
right.
the city.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually got three levels here of expanding responsibility. And this is a, you know, this is an important point, because people will like make fun of the Bible and say, if your son drinks and eats too much, are you going to stone him? Of course not. This is not something that can be carried out by an individual family even. This is something that has to be part of a community of observance of the Torah, something that doesn't really exist in modern, like, I'm basically a whole society of observing the Torah, and that's something that doesn't really exist today. So in that sense, this is one of these commandments, kind of like sacrifices that we can look at and say, and really I think a lot of the things we're reading in this section are things that we could say, okay, these are ideals that maybe one day when the Messiah comes, you know, although at that point I don't think this will be an issue, but when the Messiah comes, these things will go and, you know, will be things we can implement. But right now, you know, this is like reading about the Passover sacrifice, you know. I can learn about that, but I actually can't go and do it.
So Deuteronomy 17 verse 6 and 7 kind of suggests that it would be the parents, particularly verse 7. Well, it says, whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death. So it would suggest, and then after the hands of all the people, it would suggest that his parents are first. So it's got to be a very, 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 very serious level, I suppose, of one who, of a son who is rebellious, who is aware of this law, who's probably been given many, many warnings, and yet he will not heed to the voice of his father or his mother, and carries on in a rebellious, gluttonous, drunkard fashion, and then he is taken to the elder. So it's really a very extreme example, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, this is verse 22, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree. Now stop. A lot of people, Nehemiah, a lot of people will connect mm-hmm. that previous passage to this one here, and I'm not saying that it's not necessarily connected, but in the previous passage, we have a young rebellious chap who's stoned to death with stones. Is it possible that they would stone him to death with stones and then hang him on a tree?
Oh, the person hung on the tree is already dead. For absolutely.
Okay, so he's not hung on a tree.
Whoever's hung, and here it's there's a connection, the connection of association that we talked mm-hmm. about in the past. That okay, here's an instance of the rebellious son who's put to death. And now, by the way, whenever anyone is put to death, they you're allowed to hang them on the tree, but only until the evening after that you have to bury them.
Right. Okay, so he's hung, what, by a rope, by a tree? Is there as an example, serves as an example, or are we talking about hanging on a tree like the impaled type?
Yes, so there are actually examples where this is carried out later in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, and in those situations, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, there's actually the express... it's expressly said that this is impalement,
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to be. It could be, you know, they could just string him up,
sure.
Not necessarily by the neck, but just string him up in a way. And the point is that people will see him and say, okay, I better not step out of line. That's
yeah.
what happens. Now, what
sure.
they would do in the pagan societies is they would do that, and then they would leave them there for months, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, basically until the body was decomposed.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of this commandment is saying you can put him up as a warning to people, but only until evening. Don't
you
leave
sure?
the body until morning.
Shall not remain overnight on the tree. You shall surely bury him that day so that you do not defile the land which Jehovah your God is giving you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. How do we understand that?
It's a curse not to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
This is apparently the message here.
But it's he who is hanged. It's not he who is not buried.
Right. Well, the point is that the point of the hanging is to leave the body exposed. And we can actually see this over in, I believe it's 2 Samuel 17,
mm-hmm.
when there's a situation where David is, and basically David has to do this to a number of people who are of Saul's descendants who had violated the treaty with the Gibeonites, and to satisfy the Gibeonites, they've got to punish them according to the Gibeonite fashion of the Gibeonites. They had these, you know, pagan practices, and so they mm-hmm. left the bodies out for the birds and the animals of the fields to come feed upon them. And actually, there was a woman who came and one of the relatives and was driving off the, you know, birds. And but mm-hmm. basically, the point was to leave the body exposed. The fact that it was hanging on a tree was just so that it'd be more visual, that it'd be like in a place where you could see it. But what was significant, the important point is that the body was exposed and it could be eaten by the animals. And that mm-hmm. is telling us to be exposed like that is a curse. That's how I read it. I mean,
okay.
Maybe there's a Methodist take on it.
We'll wait for that.
Right. So he who is hanged is accursed of God. Chapter 22. You shall not see your brother's ox or your sheep going astray and hide yourself from them, you shall certainly bring them back to your brother. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it, and then you shall restore it to him. You shall do the same with his donkey, and you shall also with his garment, with anything that your brother has lost, kind of a lost and found, right? And you shall do likewise. You shall not hide it.
So I have a question here, guys. I'd like to confess something. I've got a dog in our neighborhood that, there's a couple dogs in our neighborhood. One of them is the neighbor's dog. He's not a very good dog. He barks a lot and all that. But then there's this other dog that
that's what he's supposed to do. That's his job.
They let the dog, in the middle of the day, he's barking, and in the middle of the night. And so the other guy lets his dog go, and the dog decided to come over to my garbage can and to knock it over and to go through and pick what he wanted, and the rest he flew all over the driveway. So would it be outside of Torah for me to have gotten my BB gun and to shoot the dog?
What?
Because that's exactly what I did. Listen to me. I'm telling you right now.
No, you didn't really do that.
Of course I did. I shot him in the butt. And he's never been back since. And this was a way of training the dog. If you come to my labor area over here and you start taking my garbage out, you're going to get shot. Okay? So I want to know if I broke the Torah. It doesn't say anything about dogs, and it doesn't say anything about trying to train the dog not to come and do certain things. That's what I want to know. Have I done some terrible thing? Do I need to repent? I haven't seen him since.
Yeah.
Jono, what happened to Jono?
I think he's having a laugh attack. Is this the Toronto blessing that's overcome you, Jono?
I don't get it. You must not erase this. I'm trying to figure out if there's anything that I've done.
You shot
wrong.
A dog?
No, I didn't shoot him with a bullet. I just shot him with a BB gun. I wanted to train him. Don't mess with my garbage can.
So all the dogs shall hear and fear. Oh dear.
Okay. Oh, well, no. I wanted to ask that question. Let's move on.
I do think it is mentioning that, you know, not now joking aside, that the verse we just read, Deuteronomy 22:1, is talking about the ox of your brother. I don't know that it would apply to a dangerous animal. Like, if you have a dog that you don't know and it's potentially dangerous, I don't think you're required to go and, put the pit bull on the leash and bring him back.
Well, it says, doesn't it? I mean, if there's a dog that's been known to bite in the past, or an ox that's been known to gore in the past, and then it's the owner's fault, and the ox.
But especially with a dog, if you don't know, then you've got to assume that it's dangerous. And this is a dog lover.
That's what you assumed, isn't it, Kate?
I think I didn't.
Oh, he was messing with your.
Found my Harry Potter books in the garbage can.
It's the spirit of Harry Potter. I knew it.
That's why I did it.
Yeah. I don't even know where we are now. Okay. All right, look, Exodus 23, verse 4. Now, before I read that, it goes on to say, you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road or hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up. And it said, and it just reminded me of that. And it goes further, of course, in Exodus. It talks about not just your brother. It talks about, Keith, your enemies. It says, where is it? You've really thrown me, Keith, I tell you what. Oh, that's funny. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. And if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. Which I just think is grand.
Yeah.
A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to Yehovah your
wait
God.
Just a second. Now, guys, listen. Here, we have done so well. We've done really well. I come on now. We have really done a good job walking the tightrope here.
We've been kind of politically correct, haven't we?
I think we really have. But now there's got to be some. There's got to be some.
You were waving
way
the flag in front of.
No. There's got to be some. And ladies and gentlemen, if you could imagine all of us being together in the same room, we'd never get through a Torah portion. So we've got Tamia looking the way he's looking, Keith looking the way he's, and Jonah laughing. Here we get to this verse, and so I want to see if there's a way around this. I want to see if there's a workaround.
You want to wear a dress?
A workaround. I want to do a workaround here. Yeah. So is there some, maybe it's a translation issue here.
Well, can we talk about the way this verse has been interpreted by some people, which I'm pretty sure
that's
is wrong?
That's what you do. There we go. Okay, thank you.
So let's start with one of the ancient rabbinical interpretations, which says that, there it literally says, and there shall not be the garment of a man upon a woman. And what they interpret that to mean is actually talking about armor. And because you could also translate the vessel of a man upon a woman, meaning the tool of a man upon a woman. So so actually there are some Orthodox Jews to this day in Israel where everyone serves in the army, mm-hmm. where they say that the women can't serve in the army because of this verse. This is the verse they point to.
Wow.
Even though obviously men's uniforms and women's uniforms are different. Their mm-hmm. point is that this is talking about dressing in any kind of military fashion. Which is certainly not something that I think any normal person would ever guess that that's what it means.
I wouldn't have come up with that one.
Me neither. The other one I've heard, and this I've heard from, I think more from, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I've heard this from some Christians, which say that this is why women can't wear pants. Have you heard that?
I have heard that one. That's, no, yeah.
I haven't heard it from this verse. I've heard it from other things, oh. But yeah, I would disagree.
Okay.
With that.
I've heard it from this verse, and then there are some ultra Orthodox Jews who would say the same thing because of this verse that women can't wear pants, and I think that actually highlights an important point of understanding this verse. That, you know, if you went back 100 years ago, women didn't wear pants, and so for a woman mm-hmm. to put on pants at least in America, I don't know about in Australia, that would have been considered men's clothing. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, women do wear pants.
Sure.
And the point is that what this is talking about, I think, is one gender dressing up to look like the other gender.
You know, and here comes the controversy.
In Scotland, men wear those kilts. Dresses, those skirts, kilts, you know, and that's kilts. Legitimate because that's part of their culture. So there's actually a cultural element here. And I would argue that if a man puts on eyeliner and eyeshadow and, you know, fake eyelashes and all the, you know, and lipstick, but he's wearing jeans and a T-shirt, he's still violating this commandment because he's making himself look like a woman, even though he put on a stitch of garment.
I want to say to Nehemia that I appreciate that taking that just a little bit further. And I would like to confess I've called Nehemia a liberal on the show, and I'd like to apologize. I don't think he's a liberal. I think what he really – no. What I mean is that I think you take a really fair view toward Scripture in terms of the balance. And I think – I seriously want to say this. I think that you really do that. But let's just deal with this verse for a second. Mm-hmm. So here's the question that I have. If a woman says, I want to the best of my ability, via outer garment, or whatever else that I wear, I really want to send the message that I'm dressing like a man. Would that apply to this verse?
I would say if it's in a way that hides her femininity and makes people think, okay, this looks like a man, or it looks like a woman dressed up like a man, then yeah, then we've got an issue.
Okay. All right.
In other words, the whole point here is that look, we all know what it is when a man dresses up like a woman. That's in our society, that's
a little more obvious.
We have that verse anywhere here. Can a man dress? Do we find that in the Torah?
What do you mean? That's the same verse. It says the garment of the man shall not be upon the woman, and and the dress of a woman shall not a man shall not wear the dress of a woman.
So Nehemia, what you're saying, and Keith, I guess both of you are saying that this is a culturally sensitive verse, regardless of where you are in the world. If you intend to wear the opposite sex, what is regarded as the clothing of the opposites, or present yourself in the fashion that the opposite sex presents themselves, then you are violating this Torah. Is this fair
enough? Absolutely, absolutely.
There we go. Okay.
So here's a question that I have. One of the great things, and I want to bring this is really, really quite awesome situation that we had. I don't know. We were in Israel during the time of Purim. And one of the things that happens, and I remember Nehemia, it was funny because of his the way he dealt with this. We were talking about this issue of costumes and how people dress and all that. And as we were talking about Purim, we were talking about a really it's such a powerful time in Israel. That for me, it was very powerful to see folks go back into the story from the Book of Esther and then bring that forward. And just, I mean, I could go on and on and on about that. But so we were talking about this at one point, and a lady entered into our conversation. You remember this, Nehemia? We were having the conversation. This lady out of the blue says, so we're trying to understand Purim because we're going to go to do these celebrations in the next day or two. And this lady says, oh, it's just simply Halloween. It's just like Halloween in the United States. And, well, this caught Nehemiah's.
See, this is one of the things Israelis will do. They always got to give you their opinion, even if they're not part of the conversation. Like, we don't know this person, and she's budging in our conversation. So
Nehemiah decided
that's
to
like nails in the chalkboard for me.
Turn his attention toward her, and it was, you know, he told her, look, you know, this is our conversation. Bud your way out. Get out of the conversation. But one of the things that happened that was really like that kept catching me off guard was, so I actually went to two different celebrations. I went to one in El Azar, and then I went to one in Jerusalem at the church that ladies and gentlemen, I went to the synagogue of the rabbi who was one of the rabbis who gave us a word of endorsement on the back of a prayer to our Father, Hebrew Origins of the Lord's Prayer. So we went to that synagogue. And now in both situations I saw this, but one of the things that was prominent just for me was the whole thing of men that would dress like women. Like, you know what? Now, because over here in the United States, when it's time to do the Halloween and the kids go out, they will they'll dress up like, you know, Superman, and then sometimes they'll do the witches and you know, whatever. But I was over in Israel and I was you know,
Harry Potter.
Watching this.
Yep.
Say it again.
Harry Potter.
Here it comes, ladies and gentlemen.
Halloween.
So I want to know. So in the Orthodox synagogue that was in, there were many men that were dressing like. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Women.
See, I don't think that's okay. I think that's a violation of this verse. Because look, dressing up that way is a tradition. It's not commanded. Mm-hmm. And so to violate a commandment in the Torah to carry out a tradition, then you've got a problem. So I think that's wrong. I don't think men should be dressing up like women.
I'm inclined to agree.
Obviously, it's an abomination, he says. Mm. It'd be like saying, well, today we're going to eat pork, or today we're going to, well, you know, do those other things.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
Like, what? What are you talking about? It's an abomination.
Wait, I'm trying to, so I can't get a fight. I can't get a fight from you on this one.
No, I reckon it's pretty clear cut.
No, it's an abomination. I don't think people should be dressing up like witches either. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's also an abomination. They shouldn't be dressing up like witches and anything pagan. So, you know, there are people who take Purim, and here I'm willing to admit, some of them have been influenced by Halloween. The original idea of dressing up in Purim is that the roles were reversed, that Haman, who was supposed to hang Mordechai, ended up getting hanged himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Jews, who were supposed to be the victims, ended up becoming the aggressors and defended themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's a reversal of roles. That's what's expressed through the dressing up. Now, that shouldn't be a license for then going out and doing something that's abominable. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, because that is so similar to or reminds people, I guess, of Halloween, probably the people who own the stores and, you know, and sell the costumes. Right. So you end up with a lot of you end up with a lot of women who dress up like sluts, and you know, and I think that's, you know, the exact opposite of what a Purim is supposed to be about. You know, Esther is another symbol of dressing up because she hid who she was. She dressed up like a Persian and she acted like a Persian. So there's another symbol there, but she didn't make herself into something. She didn't cheapen herself. On the contrary, she was noble. So I think there are people who abuse it, and part of the abuse I can blame on the people who on the Halloween people. I think there's some blame. There's some legitimate blame there that the Jews in this instance, we've been influenced by negative things because of the similarities of some of our traditions. Some of those other traditions have rubbed off.
So it's really interesting. The reason I want to bring this up, the synagogue that I went to with a Orthodox synagogue where the men sat separate from the women. The women could not sit on the ground level. They had to go and sit up in the balcony. But the Reform synagogue that we went to wasn't like that. It was mixed. And what I thought was so interesting was here you had the more Orthodox synagogue where the women couldn't sit on the main level, but you had a bunch of men dressing like women.
Yeah, that is bizarre.
It was bizarre. I mean, the point was just that you know, there's this rule. We can't have the women down here, but then they had the men dressing like, oh, just was really something. Mm. Okay, that's my Purim story, and we can move on.
There it is. If a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way, in a tree or on the ground, or young ones or eggs, or the mother sitting on the young ones or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with its young. You shall surely let the mother go and take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. And that's fair enough. When you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet.
Okay. Parapet, which basically means like a fence or a gate or something. Not, you know, like a railing.
A railing. Yeah, a banister, really? Sort of a, there you go, it's a new word, a parapet. For your roof, so that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household. Now, Keith, that's what you need. You need a parapet around your
bin.
Let
me tell you guys something. I was yesterday, I'm in New York City as we're doing this right now, and it's hot. Today it's about 90-some degrees.
Yeah, I heard it's a really bad heat wave there.
It's a really hot heat wave yesterday and today. So I'm in New York City, but yesterday, the day before yesterday, I actually did a little walk with my wife, and I said, hey, I'm going to take you down to the Brooklyn Bridge, and we're going to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. It's really, I mean, New York's an amazing city. You know, there's so many things in New York, but one of the things that we did was we walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, but for 85% of walking across the Brooklyn Bridge, you can't see outside the bridge. You literally are walking, and they've got these walls. And on the side of, so you're walking down this boardwalk. I mean, the whole point of walking across the bridge is to see the water.
The view, yeah.
You know, it's the view. That's why I'm talking on the, and for 50, 60% of it, I'm walking. I can't see anything other than the people in front of me and this wall that they've built on both sides. Mm-hmm. Why have they built this wall? Because now they've got it to the place where you can't walk on the edge of the Brooklyn Bridge and, like, jump over. Like, you can't jump off the Brooklyn Bridge anymore. They've put up a parapet. You can't. It's worse than a parapet. You can't even see. You can't even see. And I just thought the despairing it was that here you've got this Brooklyn Bridge now where you can't see it. And the reason, and I'm going way off, you know, script here, but I just thought about that. What's where our society has come to where that now they had to put this safety net, if I can put the safety fence up. Because of how many people that were in despair, I guess, that were literally going to the Brooklyn Bridge. You literally can't do that anymore.
It's ended all.
Yeah.
But you'd think you'd have a mesh fence or some sort of perspex or something like
that. No, you can't even get to that part of it. You can't even get to that part.
Man. But there it is. But
Wait, so what do you do if you want to jump off a bridge? I don't understand.
You can't do it from there.
You got to find a different bridge.
No, you got to bring a rope and an anchor, and you got to sort of sort yourself out.
You got to go through an entire process. It's not.
You got to learn to scale a wall before you.
Right. Right.
Dear me.
So then you dress up like Spider-Man before you do that, though.
Yes.
Bring it out for him.
You know what? I've heard, I think it was the best advice I ever heard from Billy Connolly, I think it was, who said, if you want to jump off a building and end it all, at least go bungee jumping first and see if you like it.
Impressive.
That's really funny. I think that's hilarious.
I think that's excellent advice. So that you don't bring guilt shed on your household if anyone falls off it. You shall not sow your vineyard.
So this actually, you know, now that Keith is done with his little story about the Brooklyn Bridge, can we actually talk about this commandment, which I think is kind of an important commandment? You might think it's trivial, but I think it's a good example where the commandment isn't arbitrary, where there's an obvious principle behind the commandment, and I think it's incumbent upon us to say, okay. This isn't just about parapets and roofs. It's really about any situation where a person can be hurt. I've got to be responsible for my property, and I've got to take precautions to prevent them from being hurt. And so I think that's very important. That the commandments, there are principles behind them, and when there's an obvious principle, we've got to say, okay, this isn't just about that. It's really about anything that is analogous as well.
Mm-hmm. There it is. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I say, Keith, you need to put a parapet around your rubbish bin.
If I had a parapet, that dog wouldn't have a hurt. Wouldn't begin hitting the butt.
That's right. You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. That makes sense. You shall not wear a garment.
Whoa! So let's stop here. What's the principle?
You're going to go around in circles, right?
Let's be honest here. Nobody here is going to be plowing with an ox and a donkey. Separately or together, unless we've got some people over in, I don't know, like Bangladesh who are listening on their wireless. So how does this apply to us? That's my question. What is the principle behind this commandment?
Wait, before we get to the application, before we get to the application, let's let Jonah read it, and then let's go to the application. We get stopped in the halfway. Read the whole thing.
You just read the verse. I didn't.
And you shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as...
Whoa. What are you talking about? Verse 10 is its own thing.
Why are we... Well, the NIV, what they do, they have this connected together. This is a thought. This joining together is a thought.
So in Hebrew, there's a space in the manuscripts that indicate this is a separate thought. It's a separate issue.
That's what I wanted you to... I wanted to let the people know. In my NIV, this is connected. In the Hebrew Bible, it's not. So I'm trying to do the NIV reading, and Nehemiah is saying, whoa.
How do they connect?
I say we stop and look at it. But here, so when I'm reading this here, and it says, do not plant two kinds of seed in your vineyard. Mm-hmm. Do not plow with an ox and a donkey. Do not mm-hmm. wear clothes of wool and linen. So the before we get to the last verse, they've connected the last verse about the tassels, but the other mm-hmm. ones, it's like, okay, these are all three things that are connected. So if they're not connected, let's talk about it. I was trying to get Jonah.
Okay, that's good, Keith, because it does appear connected in mine as well. And it certainly, when you read it all together, it appears 9, 10, 11, there is a mixing, right? There's a mixing going
well,
on.
Well, and that's the principle of association that we've got. We talked about this. Now, here's another thing. It's a little bit similar. Mm-hmm. Might be a different principle, but it's kind of similar. And here's a third thing. That sounds similar as well. But verse 10, what is the principle? Because look, I can't tell you what the principle is in verse 11. I honestly don't know.
Hybridization.
Hybridization? What are you talking about?
Jonah's going to tell us about that one. Let's deal with the one you can tell us about.
Right. So verse 10, do not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Mm-hmm. And I think the principle there, what jumps out for me, is that one of those animals is of a different strength than the other animal. And if you plow with them together, you end up essentially torturing an animal. I mean, so the principle that jumps out for me in verse 10 is that one of the animals is of a different strength than the other animal, the mm-hmm. ox and the donkey. And if you end up plowing with them together, the result is that one of the animals is going to be tortured. And essentially, I believe the principle behind this commandment is cruelty to animals. It's giving us guidelines not to be cruel to animals, like shooting them in the butt with a beach gun.
This is why he wouldn't let it be connected. He had his agenda.
Don't. I'm
the reason, when I look at verse 10, I'm thinking, okay, so you've got an ox, which is clearly a stronger, much stronger animal than a donkey. I mean, a donkey is a very strong animal, but they're different heights, they're different weights. And as you say, Nehemiah, one of them's going to be incredibly uncomfortable, more so than the other. Mm-hmm. And because they're not equally yoked. And the other thing is that it's going to really, I was going to use an Aussie word there, but I won't. It's going to mess up your field. You're going to be going around in circles. It's not going to be straight, and it's just going to mess it all up. And so there's another reason, and it just makes sense. It's not good farming practice to plow your field in such a way. And everybody knows that if you're going to have two animals pulling a plow and you're plowing the land, you're going to have two equal animals. And it begs the question, I mean, if you're plowing with two goats, for example, but is it okay to plow with a goat and a dog? I would say no. I'd say the same would apply.
I see.
So basically,
if you shoot that dog with a BB gun, it'll go a lot faster.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you're saying you can't have like a cat and a dog pulling the sled if you're in Alaska?
I would say that the cat and the dog is not an efficient way of pulling the sled, and I don't think that it displays a nation of wisdom.
What about a chihuahua and like a husky?
Hey, there you go. Now there's two dogs. Interesting. There it is. That's okay. Very good.
We'll have to pray about that one.
Let's get to the next verse so I can hear this application on the next verse.
Hang on, let me give you the previous one. The chihuahua and the husky, we'll let that go for the listeners in the comments. But you shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed. Now, if you sow, I don't know, you've got grapes and you've got your vineyard there and you've got flowers. I don't think that's what it's talking about. What I'm inclined to understand here is two different types of grapes. Because as the pollination takes place, like say you got your white wine grapes, your red wine grapes on the other side there, and you're sowing them together. My understanding is that as they're pollinated, you're going to get a seed that is going to produce a mixture of both of those. I don't know. It seems to me to be like either have red wine or have your have your white grapes or have your red grapes, or but don't mix it up if that's not your intention. Like it says, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. The yields of your seed.
It actually says in the Hebrew, sanctified.
Set apart, huh?
Lest the overflow and the seed which you sow, the overflow of the seed which you sow and the produce of the vine become, sanctified. And actually it may be that we're talking about planting, wheat in between the rows of
barley.
Of the vine.
Of your vine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sanctified. That's interesting.
That's what it sounds like to me, yeah.
That's interesting. Verse 11, Nehemiah, what do you make of it? I think we've touched on this before, but you better give it.
Yeah, so my take on this is it's pretty straightforward. Do not wear shatnez, which is this foreign loan word. We talked about this when we did Leviticus 19. And then it defines it here for us. It says wool and linen together. And so that's essentially a garment or a cloth, a garment made out of a cloth where, you know, you've got the what do they call that? The weft and the you know, you've got like the checkered pattern of the strings, of the threads.
Okay.
So if you have one of those in one direction is wool and the other one is linen.
Is linen, yeah.
We're not supposed to wear a garment like that, and that's called shatnez in ancient Hebrew for whatever reason.
Uh-huh.
So why is that? And here I don't know. I don't have an answer why.
So it's interesting that, of course, in verse 11, Keith, such as I have, but it's obviously in italics, the such as is not there, and it's suggested as such as woolen linen as opposed to
linen
mixed together, yeah.
So the Hebrew does not have such as. The woolen linen together is defining it, and this is very common where Hebrew will give an abstract term followed by the concrete definition. And one of my favorite examples is where this is like an Exodus 20 or 21 or something where it talks about the woman says going out for free without money. Well, what do we need without money for? You said for free. So it gives you the abstract term free, and then it defines it without money. And there's another place where it says, you know, something about a woman being a virgin. She did not know a man, right? Well, we know it. Why do we need you to say she did not know a man? But that's the style of Hebrew, that it'll very often give the abstract term virgin followed by the concrete. She did not know a man. And here
that's why we'll look at Isaiah 7:14
together.
We'll look at Isaiah 7:14. Of the virgin.
Wait, what is that? Isaiah
14.
That's got nothing to do with it.
That'll take us on a rabbit trail. Listen, you troublemaker. Hey, Nehemiah, quickly, just remind everyone, Leviticus 19:19, I've got, you shall keep my statutes, you shall not yet let your livestock breed with another kind, nor shall you sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you.
See, it doesn't say that in Leviticus 19:19. What it says is,
don't you remember that, Jono?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talked about it. It says, you shall not, literally it says, that's the wrong verse.
It says,
it says, in a garment, a mixed garment, shatnez, shall not be upon you, shall not go upon you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's fine what shatnez is because, you know, they knew ancient Hebrew. They spoke that language.
I'd like to give the verse 22 if I could.
Go on.
So, make tassels that have 614. 13 commandments in them on the four corners of your cloak you shall wear. Now, if you look at this deeper in the Methodist, there's a certain way. There's got to be five knots on the tassels to represent the five books of the Torah.
What shade of the shade of blue? I mean, you've got your shade.
Well, that
of blue.
We do know that earlier about the color blue that should be there. I have no issues with that, but I'm looking at how to make the tassels.
Please.
And there's a secret way to do it. And it's my understanding that Nehemiah knows the secret way to do it. So, Nehemiah, would you please tell the people where you got the instructions on how to create the tassels, the tzitzit?
Yeah, so there are no instructions. There's different traditions of how to do it.
What do you mean there are no instructions?
There's different traditions of how to do it. Now, what we know is that the word gedilim, that you're translating as tassels, actually means like ropes. And then and the word in Numbers 15 is tzitzit, which means like a braid. Or I believe in England, maybe in Australia, they say plaits, like of hair, like where they, you know, braid the hair.
Yep.
So we know it's. I mean, and think about what a rope and a braid have in common. They have like some kind of twisty tie pattern. You know, they're like twisted around each other.
Maybe.
So that's all we really know is that they're supposed to be twisted around each other. And
well, how do you do?
It could be done in many different ways.
Okay.
It can be done in many different ways. There's different traditions of how to do it.
So here's an opportunity to be creative, right?
Absolutely. Creative? And I wouldn't say one tradition is, you know, better than another tradition. I think they're, as long as they've got some blue in there, then, you know, we're good to go.
Beautiful.
I'm going to be creating some, what I call the, those who've joined themselves to Yehovah Tzitzit. They will be available by the 7th month, and you'll be able to order them directly on Truth to You. Right on the side, you'll be able to get your own tzitzit based on the Methodist view of the Torah.
Yes.
Now, here we are. We're in, okay, verse 13. It kind of heats up a little bit here. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found her, she was not a virgin. And then the father and the mother of the young woman shall bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city gate, and the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as a wife, and he detests her. Now he is charged with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin. And yet these are the evidences of virginity, and they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him, rightfully so, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days.
Okay.
It is what it says.
That's what it says.
Okay.
And it seems to be very clear. And I want to just say, this is an example where, honestly, when you read this, it doesn't seem like it seems very clear. It's not. We don't have to do a lot of guessing of what we're talking about here.
No,
it just seems very clear. Yeah.
But if the thing is true, and the evidences of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of the city shall stone her to death with stones because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. And I suppose the implication there, it seems fairly clear, that she has played the harlot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm not so sure it's all that obvious.
Why
is she being put to death?
It would appear because...
What has she done wrong? That's my question.
It seems like she's deceived her father, right? And
well, she's deceived her husband, that's for sure.
And her husband. Remember, the father believes that she is a virgin, and she hasn't said anything. The wedding has taken place. The husband believes that she is a virgin.
What's implied here is that she must have said at some point that she was a virgin,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you know, if she had come and said, "Look, you know, I was riding a horse, and you know,
sure, yeah, yeah,
something
sure.
happened," then you know, he would have no All cause right. against her.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, look, that happens.
So I think
the implication here is that she was claiming that she was a virgin, and, mm-hmm. and maybe it was even verified at some point that she was a virgin.
And it was the understanding of her father as well.
Right. And here's something we've got to remember. In the Torah, if you're engaged to a woman, then any relation outside of that is adultery, and mm-hmm. both for her and for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I read this, what it sounds like to me is she got engaged as a virgin, and then on the wedding night, she wasn't a virgin anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she's stoned, because she has obviously committed adultery at some point.
Sure.
Between when she got married, when she got engaged and her wedding night. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's come up later in the passage about women who are engaged.
I'm gonna get to that.
But they have the same obligation of fidelity as a married woman.
Yep.
Okay.
If a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. The man that lay with the woman and the woman, you shall put away the evil from Israel. If a young woman who was a virgin betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman, because she did not cry out in the city. Obviously, we're talking about a populated area, right? And the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife. So you shall put away the evil from among you. But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, not a populated area, right? So, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her, he shall die. And so he should. And so, but you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death, For just as where a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, but there was no one to save her.
So I think this is a pretty profound passage, because basically it's saying that for a woman to be raped is like for a person to be murdered.
Mm.
That's how significant it is. And you don't blame a murder victim just like you wouldn't blame a rape victim. That's mm-hmm. pretty profound.
Right. Amen. Mm-hmm. Even so is this matter.
There's an issue here, of course, with, you know, how do we know if she's being raped? And so that becomes the question of, you know, did she have the opportunity to cry out?
Mm.
And if she did, then, you know, was there anyone there to hear her? So if this is a dark alley at night and no one is around, even if it's in a city, and I would mm-hmm. say any modern city is basically the equivalent of the countryside in ancient Israel, that, you know, you could be in, you know, I mean, there's famous examples where a woman was, there's the famous mm-hmm. example in New York where the woman was murdered and was crying, and it took a long time to murder her, and she was crying out, and nobody came to save her.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, I would say the modern city is the equivalent of the ancient countryside. But if you're in a little, if you're in a little village and the woman screams, everybody comes running.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Okay. So.
Excellent point. If a man finds a young woman who is a virgin who is not betrothed, then he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her, he shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He shall not permit, he shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. Now, we see an example of this, right? This is Jacob's daughter and the prince of Shechem. Is that correct?
I don't agree. I don't think that's the example at all.
No,
we had a big brouhaha about that.
We did, didn't we?
Did we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we had a big brouhaha.
Anyway, so the question is, what is happening in this scenario? Is this an mm-hmm. instance of rape, or is this a situation of seduction? And I argue this is about seduction. And the reason I say that is two reasons. One is almost verbatim. We have the same exact description in Exodus. I remember we actually had an earlier example of this with the straying animal and the animal under the burden, where in Exodus it said of, you know, the animal of your enemy, and in Deuteronomy it's the animal of your friend mm-hmm. of your fellow. And so Exodus and Deuteronomy will often present things slightly differently, but it's essentially the same sort of scenario. And so there in Exodus, when it described this, it specifically mentioned the word seduction. It said when a man seduces a woman. Now, here it says he grabs hold of her. Now, does grab hold of her necessarily mean that he's raping her? And I want to turn you to Genesis chapter 39, verse 12. And can you read me what you have in your translation?
Just before you do, I just want to read that. That's Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price, which apparently is 50 shekels, for her to be his wife. If the father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay the money according to the bride price of virgins. But am I looking at the wrong verse? Because you mentioned the word seduce.
Well, so yours had the word entice, but in Hebrew it's seduce.
Entice. Thank you. Genesis, you were saying.
Yeah, Genesis 39:12, and this is describing the wife of Potiphar and going after Joseph. And what do you got there?
Okay, so 39:12 says,
she caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak.
Yeah.
Okay. So the word caught there is the exact same word as in Deuteronomy, where it says he grabs hold of her, or however yours translated that.
Ah, right.
So she grabbed him. It literally says, and she grabbed him by his garment, forcefully, saying, lie with me. It was
forcefully. And against his will.
But no, she's seducing him. I mean, and he doesn't want to go for it.
Yeah,
it's
against his will, right.
She wasn't trying to rape him, though. I mean,
She's grabbing him. I mean, that's. I mean, I suppose
she's grabbing him. She's grabbing him in passion. She's impassionately grabbing him.
Sure. Okay.
And he doesn't go for it. So, you know, the woman over there in Deuteronomy, she's being enticed. He's, you know, passionately grabbing hold of her, and she can go for it or not. That's her choice.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Okay. Verse 30, oh boy, you know what? We're almost finished. This is the last verse of chapter 22. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's bed. Mm. Now, who did that?
By the way, in Hebrew, that's 23:1.
Oh, really? That's the first verse of the next chapter. Interesting. Yep. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Shall not take his father's wife. Now, that was that Reuben?
Sure was.
There it was.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't score brownie points on that one. Chapter 23, at least in the English. This just makes me cringe every time I read this. He who is emasculated by crushing, or or mutilation shall not enter the assembly of Yehovah. I don't think you'd be able to walk, let alone enter. I mean,
well, what does it mean to enter the assembly of Yehovah?
Fill us in.
Oh. What?
Okay. Or if he was shot with a BB gun.
No. Come on. I mean, listen. I'm doing my best to get through this section. Okay.
Why does it
My question is, what does this really mean to enter into the congregation of Yehovah?
Okay.
The issue is, may enter the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean may enter the assembly to serve, or may enter the assembly to worship, or is this a technical term?
Well, you know, when I read that, I'm thinking like entering into the assembly. I'm thinking of feast days and you know, the holy convocations, things like that. That's what enters my mind, Nehemiah.
Okay, so we've got to look at a passage. This is actually referred to back in, or it's referred, they refer back to this in Nehemiah 13. So we've got to read that passage.
Mm-hmm. Nehemiah chapter 13,
verses 1 through 3.
And it says, on that day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of all the people, and it was found written that no Ammonites or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. And so it was, when they had heard the law, that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel.
So does yours say mixed multitude, Keith?
Give it to me again.
Nehemiah 13:3.
Nehemiah 13:3. Okay. Nehemiahswall.com.
Nehemiah's Wall, by the way, Nehemiah's Wall.com, his new website. There it is. Get the new book. It's called Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence.
Yes.
What's the Hebrew power of the priestly blessing unleashed.
There it is.
Got to get it if you don't have it already. What's wrong with you?
All right. Oh, on that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people, and there it was found written that the Ammonites, Moabites should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, and had hired Balaam to call a curse down upon them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. When the people heard this, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent.
Foreign descent.
Right. And there's another verse we've got to look at. Okay, hold on.
Just to put this into its context, I think I need to read the next few verses Deuteronomy 23. So while you're looking for the second one, let me just keep going here. Mm-hmm. One of illegitimate birth shall not enter the assembly of Yehovah, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of Yehovah. Now, illegitimate birth, we've got to address that. And it goes on to say, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of Yehovah, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of Yehovah forever, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. Nevertheless, Yehovah your God would not listen to Balaam, but Yehovah your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because Yehovah your God loves you. You shall not seek that peace nor that prosperity all the days forever, all your days forever.
Okay, and that's essentially the last part is what was being quoted in Nehemiah 13.
Yep.
And as a result of reading that in the Torah, they removed all the Erev, which is the mixed, from Israel. And it's not exactly clear mixed what. It goes on to talk about how there was this relationship that one of the priests had with Tovia, and Tovia was an Ammonite. It was actually an Ammonite name.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear about him in other places, Tobias the Ammonite. And so he was essentially kicked out of the temple. He had been serving there in the temple and was kicked out. So that's a reference to it. And the other one is in Ezra chapter 9, verses 1 to 2. And here it's a little bit more clear. So can we read that?
Ezra 9, 1 to 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. When these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the daughters, the Egyptians and the Amorites.
Keep going.
For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass.
So we've got a situation here where they're intermixing with these idolaters, marrying idolaters,
mm-hmm.
and I guess you might say they're unequally yoked, mm-hmm. and this becomes a situation where they need to separate from them. And so some people look at this and say, okay, when it says an Ammonite and a Moabite can't come into the congregation of Jehovah, it actually means they can't marry an Israelite. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is to say that to come into the congregation of Jehovah means actually to enter into the temple. And that's actually more consistent with Nehemiah 13, which talks about Tobias having a room in the temple. Mm-hmm. And then the other passage that supports that is Lamentations 1:10, which says, the adversary has spread out his hand upon all her pleasant things, for she has seen that the heathen entered into her sanctuary, whom you did command that they should not enter into your congregation. And the phrase is almost exactly what it says in Deuteronomy, not to enter into the congregation.
Sanctuary.
And so entering into the congregation actually then in that would then mean to enter into the temple. So an Ammonite and Moabite wouldn't be allowed to enter into the temple, which then raises the question, what about Ruth? Ruth the Moabite.
That is the question.
So there's different answers. The rabbinical answer is to say this only applies to the Moabite males, not to the Moabite females. Mm-hmm. I think that's ridiculous because we definitely saw that there was an issue with Moabite females in Ezra chapter 9. And
Let me ask you a question, because what I've got here in the English, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of Jehovah, even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of Jehovah forever.
Right. All the commandments in the Torah are in the masculine.
Okay.
And they also apply to the feminine. So for example, in the Torah, in Hebrew, when it says thou shalt not murder, the word thou is actually the masculine form of thou, but obviously it also means thou in the feminine.
Right. Yes.
And so the fact that it says his doesn't tell us whether it's a man or a woman.
Sure.
All the commandments that are stated in the masculine, unless they're gender specific commandments, apply to the feminine as well. Like there are actually specific commandments where it talks about a male. It doesn't say he gets circumcised. It says the male gets circumcised. Mm-hmm. So that's gender specific, and it specifies the gender. Whereas here, this is something that is not, I don't see how this would not apply to a woman as well. I think the issue with Ruth is she became an Israelite, and she becomes an Israelite in chapter 1, verse 16. Maybe we can read that, because that's a pretty powerful passage. It explains she's entering the land of Israel, and let's see, verse 16.
She says to Naomi.
Mm-hmm, verse 16.
But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God, and where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Jehovah, do to me, and also more, if anything but death parts you and me.
So here she's actually saying, your God is my God, and your people is my people, and she's mm-hmm. sealing that with a vow. That's not just an offhand statement.
Mm-hmm.
She's saying an actual oath. So shall Jehovah do to me, and even worse, and even more. That makes it into a vow. And so that's a legally mm-hmm. binding statement. So she, at that point, she joins herself to the God of Israel and the people mm-hmm. of Israel. Mm-hmm. She's living Isaiah 56. She's living Isaiah 14, joining the God of Israel, adding herself on to the people of Israel.
Certainly.
And at that point, she's no longer a Moabite in Deuteronomy 20. Yes. Deuteronomy 23 doesn't apply to her anymore.
But also an agreement, a covenant, a vow of sorts mm-hmm. does take place prior to that, in that she marries an Israelite man.
Well, she marries the Israelite man when she's in her country, in Moab.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, we don't know for sure, but so her husband and her brother-in-law both died.
Yes.
So I don't know that they were necessarily the most righteous men.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. We don't really know. But we do know at this point she is, and her sister-in-law, when the mother-in-law says to both of them, go back to your people, the sister-in-law says, okay, you're right, I need to go back to my people.
Not
she goes
idea.
Back to her people.
Mm.
Ruth says, no, your people are my people and your God is my God. I don't got no other people or any other God.
Mm.
Amen.
There it is. Okay. Verse 7, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you are aliens in his land. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of Jehovah.
Okay, we have to at least ask one question. Mm. So the significance of the 10th generation. So is the 10th generation legitimately counted to the 10th generation, or does the 10th generation represent the same as, you know, for a long time?
Well, no, it says Ad Olam, forever.
Okay.
So saying to the 10th generation just means, even to the 10th generation, meaning it basically just means forever.
Mm-hmm. There it is.
You know, because in verse 4 it repeats that. And 10 is just like, you know, basically just a whole number. You know, it's rounding off. It's not necessarily a, you know, 13.5 generations. It's
sure.
not
that was the Methodist softball I was a, pitching. I was okay. pitching the Methodist
hey,
softball.
Hey, we skipped the illegitimate child in verse 3. What do you got?
Yes, let's go back there. Verse 1 verse in mine.
Okay, sorry.
Keith, what do you got? You got verse illegitimate one. Child, Keith?
Verse which one?
23.2.
No one born of a forbidden marriage.
Whoa.
Okay. So let's put it on the table. The word in Hebrew is mamzer. And if you have children listening, you might want to turn this off or fast forward. But so mamzer is the Hebrew word that normally is translated bastard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the historical Jewish definition of bastard? And when I say historical, I really mean rabbinical definition. The rabbinical definition of bastard is somebody born of a forbidden marriage. Exactly what Keith's translation says.
Oh, the NIV wins points again.
Well, not so fast.
Oh, okay.
We're not there yet. Oh, hold
okay.
on. So, you know, I have no problem looking at historical sources and seeing how things were traditionally interpreted, but it's got to fit scripture. Mm-hmm. And you'll see in a minute this doesn't. Okay. So mamzer in the rabbinical sense means somebody born of a forbidden marriage, which could be adultery, it could be incest, it could be, you know, those are basically the two main categories, incest mm-hmm. and adultery. And let's talk about the Christian definition of bastard, because this confuses a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They'll say, oh, you know, my mother wasn't married and therefore I'm a bastard and I can never come into the congregation of Yahweh. And, you know, no. So the Christian definition of bastard is anybody born out of wedlock. That's, you know, in Judaism, mm-hmm. if the man has sex with the woman and impregnates her, then essentially they're married unless he's married to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Now is that the correct definition? Now I looked this up years ago. I did some research on this, and I found out that in the earliest rabbinical sources that talk about mamzer, about this term, they actually didn't know what it meant. They actually talk about, they say, we don't know what this word means. We forgot the meaning. And then they talk about how some rabbi found a scroll, and based on that scroll, they think it means an illegitimate child. Okay. So this is an actual ancient tradition. This is something that the rabbis said they actually forgot the tradition of what it meant, mm-hmm. and then claimed to have recovered it allegedly. Now mm-hmm. let's see if that really fits with what we find in scripture. So this word appears twice in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, and the second one is in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 6, and it's talking about how there'll be this situation where the Philistines will be conquered. And it says, and the bastard, or literally it says, and the mamzer shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the glory of the Philistines. That's what it says in the Hebrew. What do you got in your English, Zechariah 9, 6?
A mixed race shall settle in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines.
Wow. That's a mixed race.
Hmm.
Oh, boy. So that base, wow. I don't even know what to say about that.
Keith, what do you got?
So,
what do you got in
No, I got to say something about Jono's translation, because Jono's translation is not Jono's fault, but Jono's translation is reflecting, essentially a racist ideology of, like, you know, the 17th century or so, or the 19th century. Am I wrong about that? I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. I mean, this sure. idea of a mixed race, what? Help me out here, Keith.
Yeah, I think Jono's definitely going down the slippery slope there.
Keith, what right. have you got? What have you got in 9-6?
So you want to go in Ezra 9-6?
No, this is Zechariah 9-6.
Okay, I'm sorry. Zechariah 9-6, it says, foreigners will occupy Ashdod.
Foreigners.
The King James says, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, which, you know, becomes almost ridiculous. Like, it makes it sound like there's this army of bastards who are going to, you know, who are going to conquer Ashdod, you know, from
How
the Philistines.
How many times are you
going to
use that word? That's all I want to know.
I'm using it in a legitimate context here. It makes no sense that this army of children of of adultery are going to marry, are going to conquer Ashdod. It makes absolutely, I mean, it's ridiculous. And and because of this, some of the Jewish Bible commentators in the Middle Ages, they said, wait a minute, mamzer doesn't mean bastard. What mamzer actually means is it's a compound word, mumzar, which means a foreign blemish. And this may have actually been the name of one of the tribes that lived in the Negev desert. And they then came out of the desert, burst out of the desert, and conquered Ashdod. And
so that it's possibly the name of the people, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we've got a series of nations. We got the Edomite and the Ammonite and the Moabite and the Mamzer. And that makes more sense. You know, the army of you know, like it makes, you know, the other interpretation, what the King James has, makes absolutely no sense. Why would there be an army of all the people in that army are of that sure. heritage?
Well, let me read to you what I've got in my little study notes here in the New King James Study Bible. I've got illegitimate birth may refer to the offspring of an illicit cultic union, such as the children of a temple prostitute. Now, where would they get that from? Does that ring a bell at all?
They just made that up.
Okay, there you go. All right. How about
that? I'm
telling
you, folks, it's the Hebrew Bible and the NIV.
The NIV.
No, the NIV isn't so bad. The NIV kind of got it this time. You know, they said a foreigner. Yeah. That actually be, you know,
another Moonstar, point,
which
NIV.
Is a foreign blemish. You know, that's actually they're on the ball for that one. But did they get it in Deuteronomy 23? And the answer is no. Like, why would you translate it one way in this verse and another way into that verse?
Sure.
And what it shows is that Deuteronomy isn't saying that children of forbidden unions aren't allowed to come into the congregation of Yehovah. Mm. Because why would Yehovah punish the children for something that their father and mother did?
Yep.
Yeah, doesn't that make sense?
And that comes up later on as well. And that's a Torah poll. Thank you for that, Nehemiah. When the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. If there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but it shall be when evening comes that he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. Also, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and it shall be, you will have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig it and turn it over and cover your refuse, for Yehovah your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you.
It's obvious to me that if there's a next show, the control translation will be the NIV. No, I'm just telling you because at this point, the New King James Version is out of control. And so,
what have you got there?
I'm just kidding. No, I really am. I'm just kidding. You're okay.
Come on, New King James. We've got to score a few more points. We can't let Keith win this late in the series. Okay. You shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his... Oh, you shall. You shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. He may dwell with you in your midst. Interesting. In the place which he chooses within one of your gates where it seems best for him, you shall not oppress him. So if the slave makes it out and he is that kind of like making it to the embassy? And
so I want to ask something that we might need to edit out, but So let's talk about something uncomfortable, okay? So there was slavery in America in the South, right? And a lot of the Christians in that time actually tried to justify this from the Bible. How did they explain this verse?
They didn't read it.
They just flat out didn't read it.
No.
The heck?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So it is what it is?
Yes, so.
There shall be no. Now I've got okay. Now I've got a few asterisks here, Nehemiah. So we.
Or if they did read it, they then said, "This is Israel, not America."
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
Take out the good bits. Apply those. There shall be no ritual harlot, no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel, or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. Couple of asterisks in there. No, that's what it says, Keith. Come on.
What do you got in yours, Keith?
17, verse 17 of chapter 23.
Okay. Yes, 17. No Israelite man or woman is to become a shrine prostitute. You must not bring the earnings of a female prostitute or of a male prostitute into the house of Yehovah your God to pay any vow, because Yehovah your God detests them both.
Hmm.
Okay. So what it literally says is, so we have the word in Hebrew, kedeshah, and Kadesha is a female temple prostitute, and the masculine form is Kadesh. So it says, there shall not be a female temple prostitute of the daughters of Israel, nor shall there be a male temple prostitute of the sons of Israel. And then it says in the next verse, you shall not bring the hire of a prostitute or the price of a dog to the house of Yehovah your God for any vow, for an abomination of Yehovah your God is both of them. Now, where did they get the male prostitute? So a lot of grammarians and experts of ancient Hebrew, they say that dog is actually a euphemism for male prostitute. And they say, you know, they actually find that in some Canaanite writings. And they say also from the context here, it makes sense that if you have the Kadesha and the Kadesh, the male-female prostitute and the male prostitute, in the next verse where you have the Zonah, the female prostitute, you would have the Kelev being the male prostitute. Maybe.
There it is.
You got to ask yourself, why would somebody bring the price of a dog to the temple? Let's go back. Why would somebody bring the wage of a prostitute, of a female prostitute to the temple? Why would they bring that? Because they're hiring her for her services through the temple. And so that actually supports the idea that the male prostitute, that the dog is actually the male prostitute.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Makes sense. Yep. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food, or anything that is lent out of interest to a foreigner. You may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that Yehovah your God may bless you in all which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. When you make a vow...
Hold on, we got to stop here. This is my favorite example of the principle of association between two commandments, and I'm sure I've brought this before. But the Hebrew word for interest is actually neshech, which literally means to bite. So you could translate it as biting interest. So this isn't just any interest. This is usurious interest, biting interest. And why is this commandment appear after the previous one? Because in the last commandment, in the last verse, we had a dog. And here we've got biting. And so this is how people remembered it.
Excellent.
And that dog might bite if you shoot it in the butt with the BB gun.
That's right. I knew there was a reason that I didn't like that dog. It was a male prostitute, and that's why I shot it in the butt.
That's why you shot it in the butt. Get out of my garbage. So
get off of my Harry Potter videos.
When you make a vow to Yehovah your God, you shall not delay to repay it, for Yehovah your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, then it shall not be a sin to you. That which has gone from your lips you shall keep and perform, for you voluntarily vowed to Yehovah your God what you have promised with your mouth. And we've touched on that before. When you come into the neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes. Oh, that's so cool. Do you know my neighbor has a vineyard? He's got a really nice vineyard.
I can't wait to get there.
Yeah, I tell you. Good wine, I tell you. When you may eat your fill of the grapes at your pleasure, but... You're not taking a bag in there and, you know, sort of cleaning up. But when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, which he also has, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain.
So you Fair can enough. Eat while you're there, but you can't go harvesting it and collecting it and taking it home. That's basically it.
And so I want to bring up something. This is not an under-the-bus situation. This is an Israeli versus a Methodist tradition. So Nehemiah and I... When we were we're coming to the end of the Torah pearls, and so I have to bring up stuff from just way back, you guys. So just bear with me, and I know that we don't have a lot of time, but one of the things that we would always prepare for the next day. This guy's a list guy. He's got lists. He decides what we're gonna do. Well, one of the things we would do is we'd go eat breakfast when we were up at the Galilee. We'd go up and eat breakfast, and it's a buffet, Jono. You go in, you can eat as much as you want. At the buffet. No, they tell you ahead of time. You can have as much as you want.
All you can eat.
It's all you can eat.
Now, take me to that place, Keith.
Jono, no, here's what, and we're going to go to this place, I'm telling you. We're going to go to this hotel in the Galilee. I'm going to take you down in the morning, and I'm going to ask you a question. I take you down in the morning, and I say, okay, Jono, you can have whatever you want. What are you going to do? You're going to eat whatever you want.
Yeah.
Okay. But after you're done eating, are you going to get a bag?
No.
I made a sandwich. I decided to take it with me.
So I said to Nehemi, you can't make lunch from breakfast. He's like, yes, I can. I've been waiting for a Torah verse that I can come to rebuke him. Nehemi, you can't go to your neighbor's house and fill up a bag.
Yeah, but that's different. I actually paid for this food.
Okay. Well, guess what, guys? He was right, because I ended up asking him for some of his lunch, just like some of his water.
You walked away going, I don't know this guy. This guy, I don't know him. I'm going over here now.
I'm tired. Let's go.
All right, here we are. Chapter 24. We're getting along here. When? Okay, let me go through the four verses here. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens, however, and it happens she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. If the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies and who took her as his wife, then, verse 4, her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before Yehovah, and you shall not bring sin on the land which Yehovah your God is giving you as an inheritance, Keith.
What I'd like to do is I want to try something completely different than what we normally would discuss here. Wow. I want to ask this question of both Jonah and Nehemiah. What is this issue? And in the United States, what happens is that if you have a divorce, you split up the property. And in many cases, if you have children, oftentimes in the United States, the wife will keep the house and the children, and the man's got to work it out somewhere else. So what is this concept of out of his house? Where does this his house thing come from? And this is an important question. I want to throw this out. I want to give you a softball. What does this mean where he can say, leave my house?
So the house doesn't even really belong to him. He inherited it from his fathers, who inherited it from their fathers. And even if he wanted to sell it, it goes back to him at the Jubilee year. And so she can't get it through divorce. It belongs to his family.
Right.
Isn't that – so that is such an amazing concept, because here's what usually happens in the tradition that I come from. We look for reasons for why man becomes dominant, or why man becomes – the final word, why man becomes the issue. So normally, and this would be read in many denominations as his house, you see, this means it has nothing to do with what you said, Nehemiah. It's all got to do with the fact that it's male, and then male therefore means the house.
No, that's brilliant, Keith. I'm glad that you
Because I think what Nehemiah just brought up is something that wouldn't be thought of. I don't think it would be thought of if you were to go in and bring that up. Why is it if Nehemiah was invited to a church and they were discussing this topic, and they'd say, okay, so the woman would say, well, my husband told me I had to leave the house because he is the head of the house, and that therefore means that he owns the house. Everything in the house is his, and I have to leave the house for that reason, and that's the biblical precedent by which he would claim his authority. Nehemiah, you wouldn't come from that perspective. You would come from the perspective of what you just said. Am I correct?
I think that's the context here, yeah.
Yes, okay.
Now can I bring up the real controversy?
Oh, boy.
Sure. We've actually talked about this passage before.
Look, I want to divert.
Oh, we've talked about this. We don't need to go into Malachi 2 and that stuff. We've done that.
Did we do that in
Torah Pearls, though? Oh, we did it when we talked about Moses getting divorced. But we got to talk about it here again. That was sure. So many months ago, I don't even remember. How are the people going to remember?
Okay.
So look, in the interest of full disclosure, I've got to tell everybody I've been divorced before, and I have. And unfortunately, this is a verse that I've had the opportunity to fulfill. I love to fulfill all the commandments. This is one I didn't want to fulfill, but ended up doing. But I wanted to talk about Malachi chapter 2. Malachi chapter 2. And before we get to that, can we talk about King Henry VIII? So those who don't know the history, the Catholic Church obviously says it's forbidden to divorce, and King Henry VIII wanted to get divorced from whoever, Catherine of Aragon.
Yep.
And so he broke off from the Catholic Church, started his own church, the Church of England, and was allowed to get divorced. So here's my question, and this is
it's a little more. It's a little more complicated than that. He beheaded his wives. And this
not
is what,
Catherine of Aragon. He just divorced Catherine of Aragon. He beheaded the second one that he married, or whoever he had a whole bunch of wives. But the beheading was after he already broke off from the Catholic Church. So the question I have is, and this is really a question of information, what is the deal in Christianity with divorce when, like, I know the Catholics say you can't get divorced, and so they have, like, the legal fiction. They'll say it was annulled after three children. So what is the deal with in Protestantism, where you two guys come from, with divorce? What's that about?
I'm going to let you fill that one, Keith.
Chapter 25.
No, no.
Deuteronomy.
No, are Methodists allowed to get divorced? That's my question. Is that
okay?
Is that
well,
a bad
here's
question?
The thing. Can I just put it this way?
Mm-hmm.
Give it to me straight.
If you read the New Testament in the context, yeah. if you read it within a vacuum, you can't get divorced.
Okay.
There are many denominations who have found ways to work this out. Your reasons for getting divorced. In other words, if I got divorced because my wife cheated on me, you're okay. But if I got divorced because I was tired of her and we couldn't work it out, irreconcilable differences, then you can't lead in certain places. And this is not the Methodist Church. The Methodist is as liberal as my friend. They have all sorts of I'm just kidding. No. My point is that many denominations have an approach where they say, well, it's based on this. And I mean, if we really got to open this door, we'd have to go over to the New Testament. Look at every issue of what the divorce is based on. Is it based on unfaithfulness, or is it divorce based on irreconcilable differences? My point is that if we do what we've done through Torah Pearls, we would actually have to have an entire section after 2 hours of Torah Pearls where we go into the New Testament, and I've done this, and look at every single verse as it pertains to divorce. But I can say this generally. The general concept is this. Divorce is not something that God wants. They would quote, he hates divorce, which is another discussion. And they would say, that this is something we just wouldn't do unless he or she committed adultery within the context of the marriage, and then you're free to kick him to the curb.
And so
that's the short answer.
And there's a couple of passages in Matthew, I believe, that is used to support that argument. And then there's one in Luke as well, 16:18, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. And there's a few other passages as well. Also, Corinthians, Paul mentions something or other that really kind of is difficult to reconcile. And so
let me say this, though. Let me interrupt you. Nehemiah, by you giving what's called full disclosure, by you opening up and saying, here's full disclosure, in some denominations, it wouldn't be because you're a Jew. It wouldn't be because of your being a Karaite. It would be because you were divorced that you couldn't stand behind the pulpit and preach for that reason alone. In other words, some people would make that the issue more than anything else. Was he divorced?
So what I think
no?
is
yes,
interesting in Deuteronomy 24, since that's the passage we're on, Deuteronomy 24, is that, look, so there's a situation here which is an abomination. We've been harping the last couple of weeks on abominations.
Yes, that's a big word.
And so here we've got in verse 4, we've got in the Hebrew, is that verse 4 in your English?
Verse 4.
Her first husband who sent her away or who divorced her shall not be able to once again take her to be his wife because she has been defiled, for it is an abomination before Yehovah. So what is the abomination isn't her getting divorced in the first place.
No.
The abomination is, nobody wanted that to happen, but it happened. The abomination would be for the first husband to go back and take her after she's become
another man's wife,
Exactly. That's the abomination. And what that shows you is very clearly she is allowed to marry another man, and she just can't go back to the first husband in according to the Torah, of course.
So the question becomes, and focusing on verse 4, the question does become, why specifically is this an abomination? Can we be conclusive in regards to this verse?
I mean, to me it's kind of obvious, but maybe that's because I've, experienced divorce that, and here's the thing, that he can take her back as long as she hasn't been with another man. And that happens all the time. People get divorced, and they're apart for a year, and they say, you know what, let's give this another shot.
Okay, so what you're saying then, if she's been dating, if she has spent the night, then even though they're not married, he can't take her back.
That's how I look at it. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's clear. She's been defiled for the first husband because she's been with another man.
Okay.
And to me that, it's obvious why.
now let me ask you another question. Let me ask you another question. What if in one's youth, wild youth, and a man takes a woman who is defiled to be his wife, hasn't been married before, but is defiled and takes her. I mean, we see the example of Hosea, right?
Right, but you're missing it, I think, because it's not that she's defiled. She's defiled for that first husband because he's been with her, and then she went with another man, Brilliant. Then she can't come back with him. That's the point.
Excellent.
So, yeah. Now we got to look at Malachi. I know we did this before, but we'll do it real quick. Chapter 2, and it is in blah, blah, blah. Where is it? I had it right in front of me. I know we've done it before, so we'll just do verse 16, okay? It says, yes. For I hate divorce, says the Lord, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. what your translations have. That's not what yes. it says in Hebrew.
What are you talking about? You can't mess with this. Nehemiah, this is the sacred cow. You
it's
can't
not what it
play
said.
With verse.
What it literally
this, is what, this is what I've got. It says for Yehovah, God of Israel, says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garments with violence, which is an incredibly confusing a phrase. Covers one's garments with violence. How is that to be? But before we even get to that, hates divorce, what are you saying?
Right. So what it actually says – so by the way, what you just read is an example of indirect speech. And just to, for those who don't remember from eighth grade or whatever it was, there's direct speech and indirect speech in English. Direct speech is to say, Keith says, I am hungry. Mm-hmm. Indirect speech is to say, Keith says that he is hungry, or Keith says he is hungry. So biblical Hebrew doesn't have indirect speech, doesn't exist. And so what your translation did is – It translated a Hebrew sentence as if it were an English sentence. But what it literally says is, for he hated divorce, says Yehovah, God of Israel, and he covered his garment with violence. Now, violence can also mean corruption. Says Yehovah of hosts, and be careful for your souls and do not betray. Now, what does betray mean? And this is, we can go back to verse 14 and read the whole passage. But basically what it's talking about, and like I said, we did this in an earlier Torah Pearls. What it's talking about here is a man who doesn't want to divorce his wife because it's embarrassing to divorce his wife. They won't let him up in front of the pulpit if he divorces his wife. And really, right. It's just a pain. He doesn't want to divorce her. He hates to divorce, so he just takes a girlfriend or he takes a second wife. Mm-hmm. That's the betrayal that it's talking about here. And the
so
person
dealing treacherously with the wife of
right.
his youth, which is what it says in the previous verse.
Is betrayal, which means to have relations with someone who's not your wife. Mm-hmm. So the betrayal, the treachery here is that he said, you know what, I'm not going to divorce her. I'm just going to take a different wife and let her languish. And she can't go out and marry somebody else, and she doesn't have a husband who's acting like a husband. So she's stuck in this limbo. That's the treachery here. And he did that because he hated divorce. The husband is the one who hated divorce. He's the same one who covered his garments with violence. And garment often is a metaphor for action.
Do you have any idea of the problems that you're causing right now by giving us the,
Hebrew?
By giving us what it says in the Hebrew? It'd be so much easier if we could just stay with the NIV that just says, quote, unquote, I hate divorce, says Yehovah, God of Israel.
Okay, so let me
so
get this
slow
straight.
Down. Slow down. Okay,
no,
you guys
because
want to,
Keith, I don't
can,
know that we actually.
He wants to open this. No, I'm telling you, he's got to slow down again. Nehemiah. So, indirect speech, direct speech.
Yeah.
Read the verse in Hebrew, translated in English, just the way it says it.
For he hated divorce, says Yehovah, God of Israel, and he covered with violence his garment, says Yehovah of hosts. And now be careful of your souls and do not betray. That's
the
translation.
Say it for the people.
What I've got. Let me read what I've got.
Mm-hmm.
For the Lord God of Israel says that he, capital H, I've got Keith, he hates divorce. Now, what Nehemiah is saying is that that's a lowercase h. That he.
It has to be a lowercase h because.
What do you mean there's no he in my NIV?
Indirect speech. Which doesn't exist in Hebrew.
There's no he in my NIV.
What do you got, Keith?
I hate divorce, says Yehovah, God of Israel.
So they actually changed the Hebrew. They, in order to translate it that way, they had to change the word sane, he hated, to saneti, I hated.
Well,
which they
the
you know,
problem.
Had no problem doing because the they problem. Don't care what the Hebrew says.
At the end of Torah Pearls, I'm shutting my NIV and I'm not using it because you have
that's,
to understand.
No, that's the official one for the Haftarah, isn't it? For the...
No. There's not going to be any Haftarah. It's over because Nehemiah. You're making it much more complicated. If we could put this on Yehovah, that he's the one who hates divorce, we can match this whole thing up. If you're telling me that the Hebrew says, no, the man who's doing these things hates the divorce, is that what you're trying to say?
That's what it says. The man hated divorce, and so he acted corruptly. I mean, violently isn't the literal translation. It's Hamas, which is, it could be violence, but it's also corruption. What was his corruption? He said, I'm just going to go have a girlfriend. I'm going to have a concubine. I'm gonna marry another wife.
This is a big deal, Jono. Let me tell you why this is a big deal. Let me tell you why this is a big deal, Jono.
because you may not know it over in Australia, but over here in the United States, there are actually people that are beginning to say that, yes, in fact, you can go out and find that girlfriend, and you can go out and find that concubine, and you can go out and do that, because if you don't want to go through the process of divorce, you don't want to treat your wife well, you don't want to treat her in a way that's respectable, honorable. What you want to do instead is, okay, look, we won't worry about divorce so that no one will keep me out of my pulpits. I'll just have a few girlfriends, and it'll be fine. They don't want to hear this Torah prose. They don't want to hear this verse. This is going to mess up a lot of the new false teaching that's going
on. I'll tell you, in Nehemiah, I don't think I don't recall that we did touch on...
No, we didn't do that. He's been waiting the entire year to drop this on us.
This is new to me. So that he hates divorce. Now just bring it to me one more time, Nehemiah. Okay, so for it covers his garment, or it covers one's garment, or his garment with corruption, or with
violence. He covers his garment with corruption.
Okay, now what does that phrase mean? What's that sentence mean?
What that means is he decides to, because he hated divorce, he decided to act immorally. And what did he do? He went, and actually, we skipped verse 14, but let's read verse 14. So maybe we want to start in verse 13. It talks about the altar is crying. And you said, why, in verse 14? Why is the altar crying? Because Jehovah testifies between you and the wife of your youth, whom you have betrayed, that she is
your companion. She is your wife by covenant.
Right. So how did he betray her? Well, betrayal in Hebrew means that he had relations with a different woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means to be betray a woman.
Sure.
It means, in English, it means that as well. To act treacherously, to betray is to he cheated on her. Why did he cheat on her? Because he didn't want to divorce her.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept her. And you know what? I think it's sad, but this happens all the time, that people, they don't want to get divorced. It's socially difficult, and it's and there's all kinds of other reasons. And so instead of acting, acting with morally and with integrity, they go and they cheat on their wives.
Mm.
And that's exactly what it's talking about here.
Tell you what, we could probably spend hours on this. We really could in verse 15, but he did not
I'm calling for a special Torah pearls on the issue of divorce. This is such an empowerful thing that Nehemiah has done. I have to give him many, many kudos for this, because what he's doing, and Nehemiah, can I just say this? Look, if it's something that you're dealing with or have dealt with, you stay away from it. You don't get on a Torah parole and say, I want to make self disclosure. What I appreciate, Nehemiah,
I can testify it would have been much easier.
Look, I'm in the middle of
socially speaking. Laksha. Yeah, go ahead.
What I'm saying is, you don't do what you did. You don't come on and say that. You say, in the interest of self disclosure, I want to tell you guys, I've gone through this very difficult thing. And let me tell you something, where I come from, you don't talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you just don't. If it happened, you'd make sure no one ever hears about it, because they judge based on a misunderstanding of what divorce is. Now, I will say something controversial, and I wish we could do this on the show, but we're not going to. It'd be really interesting, and I've done it, to take a peek in Hebrew Matthew regarding this issue of what Yeshua says regarding divorce. But that will be for another show.
I think they have to wait. Yeah, 2 years from now, we've got to do Hebrew Matthew.
Hebrew Matthew.
After the Haftarah.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. All right, let's move on, folks.
My goodness. Okay, we're going to have to do we will do at some stage in the future, we're going to have to address this topic specifically, because it deserves some serious time. But we're going to move on. Brilliant. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war. There you go. Or be charged with any business. Hey, nice. He shall be set free. He shall be free at home 1 year. Oh, holiday for a year. That's grand. And he is to bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken.
Come on with that.
Nice. Yes.
In all seriousness, I think this is really, really, really powerful. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I think when you do get married, there's probably no important time. It's almost like when you have children. Those first 5 years for your child is the development of your child's brain and development of the social world, all sort of many things. And I remember making a decision, and this is connected. I was offered a job before I had my first son. And the man who offered me the job said these words to me. He said, listen, for the first 1 to 3 years, you won't have any time for your family. You won't have any time to be able to be with your children. But after you've gotten through those first 3 years, you'll be able to have, everything you want. And I pulled up to a friend's house who had a little daughter that was 3 years old, and I didn't know what ages meant. So I said to him, how old is your daughter? He said three. And I looked at her, and I made a decision that I wouldn't take the job because I didn't understand what it, I didn't understand up to that point what it meant to invest in my children at the young age. Why this is so powerful is that it says for that first year you will not go off to war. So what's happening in that first year of marriage? What's really happening? It's not just to get to know you. And this is like foundational to what's going to happen in the future of that marriage. There's got to be time, effort, energy, et cetera, put into that situation.
Mm-hmm. So now, guys, we've got to kick it along. I mean, we're going to set a new record otherwise. And I don't want to leave out verse 16, but is there anything in chapter 24 that you want to highlight between there?
I want to talk about verse 6. Are you kidding me?
There we go. Verse 6. No man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. What?
Yes.
It literally says, so first of all, this is talking about taking collateral for a debt, for a loan. And it's saying you can't repossess an upper millstone or a lower millstone. That's plain old English of what it says. You can't repossess the upper or lower millstone because he will be repossessing a life. That's what it literally says in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Or for the, literally, it's for the soul he is repossessing. It's a person's life you're taking if you take their the source of their livelihood. And I think that's an important message for us to be aware of. You know, today we live in a society where they come and they take people's homes away all the time. And here are these rules about how if you're going to be taking away the the pledge, the collateral, that you've got to stand at the door and wait for the person to bring it out to you, and you know, later on in the chapter. And so I think that's something for us to remember that there's some problems with the way our society works when it comes to debt. Mm-hmm. That's an understatement. Anyway,
sure, absolutely. Okay, so I'm jumping to 16, okay? Is that right?
Yes.
Sure.
Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. I just wanted to read that out, and I know we've touched on that a number of times, but it's so important. Ezekiel 18 and Ezekiel 33, and I'll put a link to that conversation that you and I had on Truth to You, Nehemiah. That's just a quick half-hour one, but it's so powerful, and everyone should be reminded.
Can I just ask a question? Now that I've made it, now that I'm in Torah Pearls and I've been doing this for a year, do I get to have some of those things where you could say, I'll put a link on, well, Keith and I talked about this situation. You and Nehemiah have got all these links. I want a link. Kidding me?
What do you mean you're going to do the show with him in Shiloh? Yes. In Shiloh. Live from Shiloh with Keith Johnson and Jonah Vandor. Watch out for the bullets flying.
Yeah, I'll bring my bulletproof jacket, don't worry.
I'm telling you, we're going to Shiloh. Okay, go ahead.
I'm looking forward to it. Okay, so moving right along. Hang on. I think I do want to read this from 19. Can I do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you reap your harvest in the field and forget a sheep in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the stranger and the fatherless and the widow, that Yehovah your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes from your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, the father, and the widow. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing.
Amen.
I just think that's great.
Amen.
I think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Now, here we are in chapter 25, and we've got to, there's some things we've got to deal with here. 40 blows. Yeah. 40. 40
Didn't
blows.
Did we talk about this? I feel like we talked about this recently.
I think we touched on this. I think we did touch on this, but boy, oh boy, okay.
It really blows.
It really blows. Moving right along. Okay, now we've got to talk about this. We have to, and we've already spoken about Ruth, and she comes up again here from verse 5 as an example here. If a brother dwells together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gates of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm, says, I don't want to take her, then the brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer, and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed.
So I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
What if so he's got a way out if he doesn't want to marry her. What if she doesn't want to marry him?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because it seems to be a right that he, a duty and a right that he still has the ability to waive.
Yeah. I think it's his duty and her right.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And I think it's implicit that she agrees. If she doesn't agree, then we got no issue here. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think, you know, the society was back then that if there was a woman who had been married, then she wasn't the most, you know, desirable from, you know, because they wanted virgins. Let's mm-hmm. call this spade.
Sure.
And so if this woman is a widow, then she's going to have a hard time finding someone else. And mm-hmm. so this is her right that her, mm-hmm. her dead husband's kin will come and marry her. But if she doesn't want that, then I think it's, you know, to me, it's obvious that she has the right to opt out.
Yeah, I would think so, because she initiates the confrontation with the right. with the elders, and if she
she's
doesn't go there, then
implies that she's upset.
Yeah.
Well, why would she be upset if she didn't want him?
Now, is he commanded? I mean, when you say it's his duty, does he have the right to reject the offer? Because we see this in action in Ruth.
That's the whole point. Here it mm-hmm. says he has the right to reject the offer.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, yeah, that's here in verse 8. I don't want to take her.
But it doesn't seem to be the honorable thing to do.
It's not the honorable thing to do, but it's something that he has the ability to do.
Now, the interesting thing is,
because there was the situation with Judah, if you remember back many
yes.
Torahs ago,
and
they didn't have the opportunity to opt out, and mm-hmm. so Tamar ends up through deception forcing him into the situation where he carries out the duty, mm-hmm. Or not forcing him, but luring him into the situation where he mm-hmm. carries out the duty, and so the Torah essentially is in a sense remedying the ancient tradition of Canaan that Judah was under, and giving us something that is more, more livable, more merciful.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, a little spit in the face is nothing compared to being a lifelong relationship with some people.
Yep. So there it is. And so, of course, we see the removal of it. Now, the interesting thing, though, in the example of Ruth is that she doesn't initiate this confrontation. Boaz does, right?
Because he's got to get the other guy to opt out.
He has to get him to agree. Yeah.
He wants the guy to opt out, and the guy does opt out. He says, "Hey, here's a sandal."
I'd like to do a commercial. I know we're getting close to the end. Jono, I got to give you some real kudos, ladies and gentlemen. I'm gonna tell you something. It's 98 degrees. I am wore out, and it's morning for me. Nehemiah is in the afternoon. I haven't heard him slurp one time. He's probably not on the coffee. But Jono has been doing this thing since about 10 o'clock at night, and he's still asking questions. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Folks, if you don't support Jono for what he does, I'm going to slap you and spit in your face. Listen, I'm telling you.
But I'm
going to
take your shoe off.
He's going to shoot you with a baby gun.
Come to your house and take your shoe off.
Here's my point. I'm asking you, folks, please. Listen, this guy has been a true warrior. Go to truth2u.org. Go to truth, number 2, letter U, and support what Jono is doing. I want you to do that. Because there has not been, and I've been on I don't know how many different radio programs, television, etc. There's not a better interviewer. There's not a better guy who can conduct this kind of stuff. There's not a better voice. And certainly there isn't a guy who is as committed as you. I mean, Jono, are we ever going to get to the end of this one? Are you kidding me?
We're almost there.
I've got one more question. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 6.
I love the accent.
Chapter 4. And let's go now to Genesis. Is that Nehemiah? Look, ask me a question, and I'll answer it, and we'll be done, okay?
And then something else
Please
I want to people is that you don't realize is that, you know, we do this program, and it goes for 2.5 hours, and then Jono sits for I don't even know how many hours and edits
it. How long
it.
To edit?
Do you want to know?
Some of the bloopers that I'm going to
Do you want to know?
Selling?
Yeah.
Do you know that I estimate that by the time we have finished this, we will have invested over 700 man hours into this program, into just Torah Pills.
Wow.
You don't want to support that, folks?
700 hours.
Thank you,
Jono.
Over
700.
And with that, I want to say a prayer. I want to say another. What I said a prayer yesterday. Nehemiah, can you have us open our eyes so that we can know it's the end of our Torah pearls?
Yehovah, b'nu shebashamayim, gal eninu v'nabita niflaot mitoratecha. Yehovah, our Father in heaven, open our eyes that we may see the wonderful hidden things of your Torah.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Now, Keith, I know you just wanted to jump over this next verse, but we've got to deal with it because I have to tell you, I actually, we're not getting away with this one. I had an atheist of Jewish descent, an atheist. We were having a conversation. He said, I don't buy it. I mean, he said, for example, and he brought up this next verse. And here it is, 25:11. If two men fight together and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him and puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall not pity her.
I don't see the problem.
Okay. Keith, Eddie, would you like to elaborate on that?
And this has been truth to you.
Come on.
Number2.org.
Now, what this doesn't mean is that a woman cannot defend herself. I mean, if she's in a situation, it doesn't mean that the
genitals... And she can defend her husband, just not by grabbing the other guy's situation.
Now it's a... And we're talking about... do you want to elaborate on that at all?
No.
I'd rather not.
It's pretty clear.
Moving right along. Weights and measures, again, Leviticus, Ezekiel 18:33. I'm going to put a link there. Mm-hmm. Let's move on from that. This is the last little passage, the last few verses of this Torah portion. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when Yehovah your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in land which Yehovah your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget.
Wow. So this is really interesting. this verse almost contradicts itself, verse 19.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you shall blot out, or it really means erase. You shall erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. You shall not forget.
You shall not forget.
Doesn't
it mean you shall not forget to do this? I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, that's the way I interpreted it when I read it. Don't forget to eradicate them.
To eradicate the memory. And I think the key thing here is the word memory. Also, it's the Hebrew word zecher, means memory, but it also means the mention. So blot out the mention of Amalek from under the heaven. Do not forget. Do not forget to do that, of course. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that this appears here is that when we talked about the what they call the levirate marriage, or that was the thing where the woman died or the man died without children, and the brother came to marry. So what it said there, and we kind of glossed over this, in verse 6, it said that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So what you blot out, what you erase, is the mention of someone's name. And the way his name in this case would be blotted out is that by not having a child. Mm-hmm. And, Amalek were to blot out the mention of their name. And, you know, one of the things that people have done, which saddens me so much, is that they've blotted out, tradition has blotted out the mention of our Heavenly Father's name.
Oh, man.
And that's a curse in the Torah, to blot out somebody's name. Amen. To blot out the mention of their name. Mm-hmm. So why would we want to curse our Heavenly Father, Yehovah, by blotting out the mention of his name, making it forgotten?
Amen. Yes.
Amen. And once again, his hallowed name revealed again. Mm-hmm. And you can find it and the website is hallowednamedot.com.
Where you can also learn about the coming tour once we get the final negotiations done. So by the time this radio show is up, you will be able to go to hishallowednamedot.com, understand how you could join us on the tour, understand everything that's going on there, and of course to support China. All sorts of things going on at prayertoourfather.com, also a place for people to go. But this has been an amazing, amazing portion. I cannot believe that we've almost broken a third record.
We broke three in a row. Three in a row, my goodness.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
What is that? That's like almost 8 hours just in recording. Anyway. It is always a pleasure and a privilege to be speaking with you guys once again on Torah Pearls. Thank you, Keith Johnson and Nehemiah Gordon. You've been listening to Torah Pearls on Truth To You Radio. We can also freely download this and other Torah Pearls programs at truthtoyou.org. That's truth2letteryou.org. And next week we are in Ki Tavo, Deuteronomy 26:1-29:8. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.